and welcome to another weekly edition of Popcorn Optional, a movie podcast where we talk all things movies. And this week, we are reviewing A Quiet Place, the new film from John Krasinski, who you may better know as Jim Halpert from The Office, but after this, he may be known as a prominent up-and-coming director. Who knows? We'll see what the future holds. We also have a couple of news items to get to before that, as well as an underrated movie segment. My name is Cameron Slania. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Jake Brown.
Hey, man. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Trevor couldn't be with us tonight. Unfortunately, he's feeling a little bit under the weather, but he will be back next week. Let's go ahead and get into some news and trailers from this past week, the first of which is that there was a new Solo, A Star Wars Story trailer that dropped. And Jake, based on our Twitter texting, we have wildly different opinions on this trailer. So why don't you go ahead and give us your thoughts on the trailer?
Well, I'm excited to hear your thoughts. Basically, I really like this trailer. This just feels like Star Wars in the right ways, but also feels new in all the ways that I wanted it to be new. I love that this is just like a totally nebulous in terms of like good or bad. It's just like, nope, it's just them being them. This isn't a good versus evil, the Force story. This is just these characters in this situation that launched the trajectory of Han Solo. And it looks like a Star Wars version of Baby Driver or like Ocean's 11, which I'm all about. The characters and tones, they feel great. It feels like it will be fun in the theater. Who knows if it'll be good, but like it looks like it's going to be fun. So I'm down. I'm optimistic. I had like super low expectations with all the drama that went on behind the scenes on this film. So just the fact that the trailer has me excited is a win.
Yeah. I had a wildly different, I've been on the fence about this movie ever since it was announced. It didn't feel like a necessary thing. It just kind of felt like a money grab. And then I obviously love Lord and Miller. I think they're great directors, and then them getting tossed out and Ron Howard coming in. But then, you know, okay, there's still Donald Glover. There's still Emilia Clarke and Woody Harrelson. There's an incredible cast. This trailer seems to confirm my worst fear in that I don't think that Alden Ehrenreich is the right fit for this role whatsoever. And I actually feel like he's very, very different than Han Solo, or at least the Han Solo that Harrison Ford has played. And it's just like seeing him in this role and trying to work just feels so weird. Like it doesn't feel natural. It feels so forced. So many things in this trailer didn't. And I get that it's a trailer, but normally Star Wars cuts amazing trailers. And I don't know, everything about this just kind of felt like forced and like, hey, look, we're funny, but we got action. But hey, we got Star Wars elements. But it just kind of felt like, it felt like they're trying too hard instead of like whenever I see, or in the past when I've ever seen trailers for other Star Wars films, it's always kind of been like, I'm blown away and they hardly did anything. But I feel like this like gives away some bits, also kind of like, it didn't have that feel that I was looking for. And I can't really describe it other than like, it didn't feel Star Wars-y and it really didn't feel like Alden Ehrenreich was the right role. Now, that being said, this is a trailer. This isn't a full movie. Who knows how he actually does, but something about this trailer just felt off and kind of gave me pause, almost like a confirmation of the worries that we would have based on the behind-the-scenes drama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I get your concerns. I do have the suspicion that based on the trailer, all of the character scenes, like not CGI action spaceship stuff, they feel very early in the film. A lot of it is like setup. So maybe we watch his character go through the character arc to create Han Solo. So there's hope there. I'm also totally cool with like the jokiness. I think people forget how funny the original Star Wars are. There are a lot of quippy little sarcastic jokes in there. So I'm fine with my Star Wars having jokes. I'm fine with it being goofy and silly. They are basically kids movies with like a little bit of edge. I think people forget that too. But we'll see.
I'm totally game with the jokiness. Like I loved the jokiness in the new Star Wars The Last Jedi, which was constantly one of the bigger complaints about that movie. But I love the jokiness. I feel like that's always been one of Han Solo's best attributes was his jokiness.
Yeah.
At least the, you know, kind of levity that he added to those movies. But in here, it just was kind of almost as if, like, instead of just being in the role, it felt like he was trying to be what he thought people expected him to be as this character.
Well, maybe that's what his character is doing, because he's trying to prove himself as a pilot to these people to so he can become Han Solo. So who knows? Maybe that's part of it.
Maybe. And if so, that's a very good catch on your part. I hadn't even thought about that, but that could be an incredibly smart choice if that's where they decide to go. But yeah, so outside of that, there's a couple other trailers to talk about. There was a trailer for Fahrenheit 451 starring Michael Shannon and Michael B. Jordan, which we've gushed on this podcast before of our love for Michael B. Jordan. So it should be no surprise that we're all huge Michael B. Jordan fans. But outside of that, are you excited for Fahrenheit 451, or does the fact that it's an HBO-only movie kind of weird you out like it would? Like, I feel like, so let me just say this. If this was a Netflix movie, I'd be like, okay, there's something wrong with it. There's a reason why they're not putting it out in theaters. Do you get that same vibe when it's like, oh, it's an HBO movie?
I mean, the name of HBO is Home Box Office, so I feel like for them it makes sense to be like, hey, this looks good. You like Michael Jordan. You like Michael Shannon. You should subscribe to HBO and watch this. And also look at all this other stuff that we have that you can watch. So that doesn't bug me that much. I think that the whole send it to the theaters thing is kind of dying anyways. Like, unless you're a big Hollywood production studio that is able to pull off a actual wide release in theaters, it doesn't economically make sense. And so I applaud HBO for doing this. Like, I think that it could be good for them. Everyone knows the story of Fahrenheit 451, and Michael B. Jordan's one of the hottest things in Hollywood right now. Haha, pun, hottest thing.
Fire.
Yeah. But
that,
like,
joke was lit.
The trailer looks amazing. I mean, like, the visuals in this are super good. And it has a really intense tone. I don't remember the book being like this at all. But I
feel like this is definitely an amped up version of that book.
Absolutely. But, like, I'm digging it, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it's exciting. We'll see what ends up happening when it comes out, but it could be great, could be bad, who knows. But it's got a great cast, which is really exciting. It's a good story. Next up is maybe the most what the heck movie trailer I've ever seen. And it's almost as if they were like, hey, you know, like what Fast and the Furious has done with cars? Let's do that with sharks.
Submarines.
And submarines. And that is the trailer for the new Jason Statham movie, The Meg, which is short for The Megalodon.
Worst
features
name ever.
Or the best name ever, because everybody's talking about it.
I thought for a second, so when I just saw you text like The Meg trailer and the link to it, I was like, is this like a weird Family Guy thing?
Yeah, and it's not.
I wish it was.
Everybody, I think, is thinking the opposite right now, because I feel like this has the potential to be an insanely fun time. Here's my worry: is there's a fine line between this, or what this could be, and Sharknado, and I'm curious how fine they ride that line.
Yeah, Sharknado though, there's a sincerity to them knowing that it's a joke, like,
right,
that makes it kind of enjoyable to watch, because you're like, everybody's in on the joke. I think except for the lead actor, he's his head so far up his own butt, he doesn't really know what's going on. But yeah, like, Mark Cuban's the president. Like, we've got celebrities wanting to be a part of this thing. Everyone knows it's a cultural joke. This feels like your typical bad sci-fi movie where everyone thinks it's like the big break for their career, but they got a really big budget and Jason Statham and Rainn Wilson. I feel so bad that we're talking about John Krasinski's meteoric rise as a director and Rainn Wilson is in the Meg trailer.
Yeah, it feels very unfortunate for him, but I'm just like, I feel like this movie might have that right tone, and it has good placement. I mean, typically August films, if you can get a good August film, you can ride that empty box office for a while.
Yeah.
And I feel like if this could be that film, if it's good. But there's a chance that it goes the Geostorm route and is just utter garbage. I mean, but there's a very, and like, once again, there's a very thin line between Geostorm and Fast and the Furious. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a level of jokiness, sincerity, comic relief, action that separates those two films. And it's just about whether or not they're able to capitalize on what they have in front of them, because, you know, there's some serious talent between Statham and Rainn Wilson. And John Turteltaub has had some hits on his hands. He's also had some very terrible things that he's done. I mean, National Treasure is a great film. Well, it's a fun film. But outside of that, it's kind of like, you know, what else? I mean, he did Three Ninjas back in the day, which is, you know, should be looked at and loved. But outside of that, it's kind of like, okay, Sorcerer's Apprentice with Nick Cage.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm curious to see what ends up happening from this. What's interesting is Eli Roth was originally supposed to direct this.
Hmm.
And I feel like I'm a lot more interested. I'm not a huge Eli Roth fan, but I feel like Eli Roth's twisted sixth sense of humor mixed with this kind of trailer would have been a lot more interesting.
Yeah. Could be something.
Could be something. Could be nothing. Could be big hit. Could be absolutely nothing. But outside of that, the number one most rented movie of 2017 was announced this week. And Jake, if I was to give you 100 guesses, would you have ever guessed what it actually was?
No, and I'm incredibly depressed that it was The Accountant.
Yes, The Accountant, starring Ben Affleck, was the number one rented movie of 2017, which just shocks me and blows my mind. And I'll be honest, I rented this movie in 2017.
it's your fault, Cameron.
So it's partially my fault, but I didn't like it. So does that still count?
Yeah, you rented it, man.
Oh, I feel so disappointed that I added to the statistic. Other notable ones were Moana and Wonder Woman. What's interesting about Wonder Woman is that of the other two, between Moana and Account, they both came out in 2016, had earlier release dates within 2017. Wonder Woman had about half the time to do that same kind of rental. So if anything, it almost feels like it's a bigger deal for Wonder Woman to be mentioned on that list because of how late in the year it came out, but who knows?
Yeah.
It's just weird. I feel like, have you seen The Accountant?
No. It was one of those things where when I saw the first trailer, I was like, this either looks like really good Ben Affleck or really bad Ben Affleck. Like,
it's really bad Ben Affleck, and it's really bad Anna Kendrick.
Yeah. They are maybe two of the best examples of like super hit or super miss and very little in between. Like, Anna Kendrick is either fantastic or like I can't stand her. Same with Ben Affleck.
Yeah. But I have such a problem with Ben Affleck lately, just because it's like he goes on this run of three incredible films between Gone Baby Gone, The Town, and Argo. And then he kind of does like halfway does Live by Night or Live by Night. I still don't even know what the title of that film is, whether it's one or the other. And then it's like he's doing Batman. He's not really directing. He's doing The Accountant. It's like, dude, you had a gold mine on your hand and you were an Oscar shoo-in years down the road if you could have just kept on this directing route. But now it's like I feel like he has to like build his career back up because he's kind of lost that flair and gotten a weird Phoenix back tattoo, and now he's doing all sorts of weird things. But outside of that, Amazon announced that the Lord of the Rings series had a 5-season commitment with $1 billion budget per season. Now let's be on the high end and say that $1 billion budget was for, 12 episodes. 12 episodes seems like a long season for something like this. That's $83 million per episode. That's Jeff Bezos money.
This seems like a terribly stupid idea.
Yes.
Like, in so many ways. First off, I don't think anybody wants more Lord of the Rings. Like, at least Well, the average person does not want more Lord of the Rings. I'm a nerd. I love the original Lord of the Rings movies, but I have watched them maybe once or twice since being in the theater because they're so long. And then I watched the first Hobbit movie and I was like, well, this is one of the worst things I've ever seen. And so I'm like, I'm out. I am out on Lord of the Rings stuff unless it's amazing. And $1 billion a season, a 5-season commitment, we always talk about this. You have to make one movie before you can make 5 movies. Mm-hmm. We're looking at you, DC. We're looking at you, Bright. We're looking at you, all of these stupid things that are trying to copy the MCU or Game of Thrones without actually putting in the work. And so this seems like a $5 billion mistake, which is something I don't get to say very often. And it sounded, it was nice to say, but I'm just like, this just seems really, really, really dumb. And you know, I might eat my words. It might be amazing, but I just think that we're, as a society, kind of over Lord of the Rings.
Are you more interested in it if Peter Jackson is involved in some capacity?
No, I'm less interested if he's involved.
Oh gosh, okay. Well,
the Hobbit, that's not good. I hated The Hobbit. Hated it. And I think he did too. Like, you can watch behind the scenes stuff of him and he just looks like he's slowly dying, like aging 20 years in that production. And I am over Peter Jackson's interpretation of Lord of the Rings. The first three were amazing. And then he lost it. So I'm out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like there are other people that need a chance or would be better off having a chance in this universe that I would be more excited about. But it's just kind of, it just all feels like it feels like a haymaker punch in a fight. Like,
yeah.
You're not like the smart people going out there. You kind of throw jabs at first, you know, you're getting a feel for what the people want or for what's going to work. And then you start getting the heavy blows. This feels like I'm going to come out of the gate swinging. And if it fails, then we're done. But it just all feels so like unnecessary when it's like, you could easily make a smaller budgeted movie and have it be just as good. Or not movie, but TV show, and then build from there. You know, Game of Thrones started out incredibly small, and now they're building to their insanely huge seasons. But it didn't start out that way. You know, you have to work towards that. And it's just this frustrating problem of people not wanting to work for the end product.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great way to put it. Of a haymaker, like if it's a Hail Mary, it's right. Them looking at Netflix, looking at HBO, and they're just like, Lord of the Rings, $5 billion, that maybe that'll do it. And it's just everyone else is like, oh, $5 billion, oh my goodness, let's watch this place burn to the ground, this will be fun. So
well, it's also one of those things where it's like, I feel like it's very much this idea that throwing money, or like the amount of money that you put into something, is also the amount of critical appraise or commercial appraise that you get out of it.
Yeah.
Like, just because you sink $100 or $1 billion into a series and it looks great, like, let's face it, you're not going to sink $1 billion into a series and have it look bad. The series is probably going to look amazing. That's mm-hmm. for sure. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to actually be any good. It's just an unnecessary series. And you're right, Jake. It's Amazon trying to catch up to Netflix, or, I mean, even in a small way, Hulu. Because, I mean, you know, Hulu doesn't necessarily have like the buzz that a Netflix show does. But The Handmaid's Tale won, if I'm not mistaken, Best Drama at the Emmys. So they at least have the critical appraise. And it's just kind of like, I feel like, oh, Netflix has all the subscribers, Hulu has the awards, let's throw $1 billion in and go from there.
Yeah.
So, have fun.
Good luck
with
Amazon.
That Amazon. And here's the thing. If it's good, I'm all here for it. And I'm pumped. I'm I'm insanely excited. If it's bad, then it's just stupid and ridiculous, and it didn't need to happen.
And so, they're out $5 billion.
Yep. but getting on to our underrated segment, this is a segment where we kind of just like to highlight movies that we feel are criminally underrated, not talked about as highly as they should be, not looked at in the public eye with as much acclaim as maybe they should, but just films that we feel deserve more credit for the work that they've done. So let's each talk about our underrated film for this week. Jake, what is your underrated film for this week?
Okay, this is arguably one of the best superhero films of all time that I feel like nobody remembers or most people haven't watched because they didn't know about it, and superhero movies are kind of in like a renaissance. I don't know if that's the right word for it right now, but this was from the 90s, starring one of our favorite superheroes, Batman, in an incredible animated film by Warner Brothers called Batman, Mask of the Phantasm.
Yes. Oh, yes. That's such a great film. You're right. I don't think about that film as much as I probably should. It's not, like, when I think about great Batman films, I think it's so easy to just look at maybe the ones that are live action and not necessarily mm-hmm. consider this just because simply it is a animated film. But man, what an incredible film.
Yeah.
The story in it's incredible.
Really good. Great story. Great animation. I mean, Warner Brothers animation for a while was incredible. I would say at Disney level in terms of story and animation quality, and totally different intellectual property, but I mean, the stuff that they were putting out at a consistent high level was so good, and Mask of the Phantasm is the pinnacle of that. One of the best Batman stories, one of the best Batman movies that a lot of people either forget or haven't seen. So yeah, check that out. It is really, really good.
Yeah, it also has arguably the number two best Joker of all time in Mark Hamill's Joker. In the voice role that he does for that, which is, say what you will about Mark Hamill as a live action actor, he is an incredible voice actor.
Oh, one of the best.
Yeah. So, Batman Mask of the Phantasm, that is Jake's underrated movie. My underrated movie is a movie that I thought a lot about as I was watching A Quiet Place for a lot of different reasons. One, the way that it handles sound. Two, you know, the kind of way that it tells its story in this contained yet expansive feel, like it's a very contained movie, but has like is told on a very large scale. And it's just a movie that intensity wise, I think I had the same. I walked out of the theater feeling the same thing that I did when I watched A Quiet Place. And that is 2013's Gravity.
Yeah. I mean, Gravity is amazing. I don't know if it's underrated because it won a bunch of Oscars.
I don't. Okay.
I definitely think that it is underrated in the sense that once it left the theater, nobody talked about it anymore. And right. I am one of those people that says it is a film that you have to see in the theater because the theater experience is so visually and just like, the sound and the visual, it hits you. It's an experience, like a physical experience, but it is still a fantastic film. Definitely think that it should be back in the zeitgeist of great films that we are talking about. So yeah, you know, I'm going to give it a tentative underrated minus.
Here's my thought about why it's underrated. I don't think anybody could argue that it's a good film because it is a very good film, and a lot of people love it. And I'm not trying to argue about whether or not it's a good film because it's a great film. But I think it is one of the best films made in the past 10 years for a lot of reasons. The single one-shot takes that they do in this are incredible. And what goes into those shots is even more incredible on the behind-the-scenes level. The story it tells is insanely well-contained, but it's so easy to follow in the way that Cuarón and Lubezki frame these scenes and film them from beginning to end is just it's magic to watch them tell this story in a way that's so concise on how you can understand the action. And for a story that kind of only really features like two characters on screen, plus like some voices and some people early on. It's just, I don't think it gets the credit that it deserves for how incredible it is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Yes, I understand it's an obvious good film, but I feel like it should be talked about as like, you don't hear it being talked about in the films that's like the best films of the past 10 years. Like, you don't hear it in that conversation. And I feel like it should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
that's a good point.
But yeah, so Mask of the Phantasm, Batman Mask of the Phantasm, and Gravity. Those are our two underrated films for this week. But let's go ahead and get into our review of John Krasinski's new film, A Quiet Place, starring Emily Blunt, Millicent Simmons, Noah Jupe, and Cade Woodward. This film had an incredible opening. On a $17 million budget, it made $71.2 million on opening weekend, which is just insane to think about. It's like, no matter what you think about the movie, that's incredibly, if you're a John Krasinski fan, that's incredibly good news, just because it's like, wow, what a win for that guy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Jake, let's get into our general thoughts of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, going off of your point on John Krasinski, he's someone that we definitely root for super hard. We are huge fans of The Office. I think it's one of the best shows of all time, and his portrayal of Jim is phenomenal. I expected really big things from him when he ended his run on The Office, but he never really found his footing, I don't think. Like, it was a bummer, too, because he took a bunch of roles that you looked at the role and you were like, that's going to be great. Like, he's working with George Clooney on that thing. That's going to be awesome. And then the film just didn't work out very well. And so it was like, man, what a bummer. And then you find out he's going to direct and you're like, oh, cool. John Krasinski directing. Let's see what happens. And then you find out it's a horror film and you're like, oh, okay, interesting. And then you see it. And this is one of the best movies I've ever seen, in my opinion. I freaking love this movie. Love this movie. This is probably one of my top 10 in a really long time that I've seen. Definitely my favorite of the year so far. I'm sure it will be in my top 10 at the end of the year unless a miracle happens. Yeah, I mean, I don't have enough good things to say about this film because I was on the edge of my seat the entire time. The performances are incredible. Cinematography is incredible. Sounds incredible. It is just, in my opinion, perfect filmmaking in every aspect. And we'll go into that more here in a little bit. But for me, this is why I go to the movies. This is why I want to be a filmmaker. This was amazing. And I can't believe it was from Jim Halpert. So yeah, I mean, I am a fanboy for The Quiet Place, and I cannot wait to see what Krasinski does next.
Yeah, it's interesting because he's directed two films before this that really didn't have really any notoriety whatsoever. In 2009, he did a film called Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. And then in 2016, he did a film that premiered at Sundance to OK Reviews called The Hollers. It's kind of a family comedy drama film and didn't get great reviews. And so it's when I started to hear the buzz about this film, I was like, man, I wonder if it's just like a good story or like, I wonder what went right. But I probably isn't John Krasinski as a director, considering he's directed two films that didn't get great reviews. And then you watch this movie, and this is the first movie in a long time that I feel like it's the first time that I've watched a movie since Get Out last year, where I was like, you can noticeably see the director's hand more than anything else in this film. Like, you can see how he molded and crafted this film in a way that got it to this point where it is now. And it's incredible. I mean, this is my, Jake, you said it was your favorite film of the year so far. This is my favorite film of the year so far. I'm shocked that I'm saying that about a horror film. Mm-hmm. 2 years in a row, there are horror films that are going to be in my top 10. Between this and Get Out and it, I'm kind of on this like horror bandwagon of like, do I actually like horror films? And because I feel like these films are starting to reinvent the way, not reinvent, but show us a way of viewing horror outside of just like gore porn or like jump scares for the sake of jump scares, but actual like depth and meaning within the horror and using that horror to teach us something about ourselves. And this film, I have never been so introspective in a movie as I was in this film. I mean, constantly in this film, I'm thinking about my relationship with my son, my relationship with my wife. I'm thinking about how we would handle something in the situation. I'm thinking about how, as a father, I would handle this situation. It's just what it's able to do and bring out of you as an audience member is incredible. It's this incredibly cathartic experience that you don't expect from a horror film, less from a John Krasinski film who hasn't really done much since he left The Office. And I feel like this is that, like, you know, plant your feet down type of film of, like, flag in the sand. This is, like, John Krasinski's coming out of, like, I'm here, I'm a director, let's go. And it's incredibly exciting because there's a lot to love about this film. And there's a lot that is done. I feel like oftentimes I like a film and I really like it, but I'm still able to acknowledge, like, there's faults in it. Mm-hmm. There's very little that I can nitpick about this film. Like, if we really want to get nitpicky, I can pick a couple things in the story. But outside of that, it's like, this is a overall great film.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely need to get into spoilers here in a little bit, because literally the first scene of this movie is a spoiler. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I totally agree with your point on, I love horror films when it's good horror. And I think good horror has good commentary on life, which is what filmmaking is supposed to be about. It's supposed to make you think and feel. And, like, you can make people feel scared, but if they're not subconsciously at least thinking about their life or connecting with the characters or connecting with the story or putting themselves in the story, that's when horror is good. When the audience learns something about themselves, about the characters, they feel invested with the characters. Most horror films just do a bunch of jump scares and have bloody stuff, and you feel scared because that's scary, but you don't have a actual connection with what's happening in the film. And so the moment the film's over, you forget about it, or like halfway through you get bored. But in this film, I mean, so much happens, so much is said, it's so deep. And it was only an hour and a half. I mean, it's a short, tight film, but it flew by. I was on the edge of my seat the entire time.
But at the same time, you get done and you go, that was only an hour and a half. Like,
oh yeah.
You're so, and that, this is where I draw comparisons to Gravity, in that, like, I walk out of that theater and, like, I'm tense. I'm sore. Like, my arms are almost, like, sore from, like, being constantly, I'm just constantly, like, on edge the entire movie. And, like, I remember, like, with Gravity, like, my hands were gripping the armrests the entire time. And I walked out and I had to, like, you know, I had, like, hand cramps. And the same exact thing happened when I walked out of this, of, like, I was so tense the entire movie, and I didn't want to make a noise because I felt like a monster would get me. And so I was like, okay, be as quiet as possible, be as quiet as possible. But it's incredible what's able to be done with this film as far as sound goes. But I'm curious, what was your theater, like, in theater experience, like, as far as the noise aspect of this film goes?
Yeah, I mean, my experience was pretty good. It was a small crowd, but everybody was super into it. My real complaint is how loud the theater next to us was. Like, I'm pretty sure it was Pacific Rim or something. And so there'd be these really intimate moments, and there'd be like a blah, 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 like that you could hear faintly through the walls of the other theater. And that was driving me nuts. But I totally agree with your point on just, like, the element of sound and sound design and how quiet this film is and just, like, how much that puts you on edge. I woke up before my wife this morning, and I was downstairs making coffee and breakfast and cleaning the kitchen. And I was so aware of every little sound, and mm-hmm. I'm a big guy. I'm a little bit clumsy, and I'm intense. I slam a lot of doors and drawers on accident. I would die immediately in this universe. I'd be dead for sure.
Yep. Oh, 100%. I noticed, like, that as I was walking out of the movie theater, I had these, like, boots on, and they have, like, this, like, loud kind of, like, heel to them. And I was just like, oh, I'd be screwed. Like, I'm toast. I would easily be killed. But what was funny was, in, I went to go see this movie with my brother-in-law, and we were sitting there.
Brandon saw it.
Brandon saw this. My brother-in-law, Brandon, is a magnificent human being who never says no to anything. He is the ultimate person to challenge on anything because he's just a blast to have. And so I asked him if he wanted to go see this, and he was, of course, excited to go see it. But we were, and Brandon is very much like me in that we get scared very easily, and it's kind of fun to scare us because we are complete wimps about it in a lot of circumstances. But in our theater, we're sitting there, and it was like somewhat as the, as the third act was starting and some stuff was starting to go down, this girl starts walking down the steps of our theater. And me and Brandon are like, you know, if there's that middle thing that you walk in, and then we were like three rows up from that. And this girl, instead of hitting like the soft carpet parts of the steps, hits the like solid plastic on every single step on the way down. And it's just this like tick, 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 oh, tick. No. And me and Brandon both just kind of like jolted, and like, it was horrifying. And it was just like every single popcorn noise, this is maybe a movie that I almost recommend watching at home, because you can control your environment as far as sound goes. Cause I almost feel like the audio aspect is more important than the visual aspect. And so like, maybe it's not as important to see it on a big screen, but to be able to control your sound environment in watching this.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. And I also disagree, but I do agree that it's like, it's so quiet and intimate that it is easy to be distracted. But that was like almost part of it, 'cause like everybody in the theater was like so on edge the whole time. I could tell like someone was trying to eat popcorn really quietly and like really slowly.
Guy in the back that's just kind of like,
oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I always want people to get the best experience out of a movie possible. And I just kind of feel like this is like, don't go watch it on like a 20-inch small screen or on your iPhone, but like go to a friend who has like a 60-inch or bigger screen, watch it at their place with people, but just in an environment where it's like you can control kind of the quietness, because it's just the sound and what it's able to do to you is piercing.
Yeah.
I want that experience for everybody. And I had outside of that one woman walking down the steps, I had a good experience, but just browsing through Twitter, there are some people that truly had some horrific experiences on a sound level with this movie. Like Jake said earlier, to talk about this film and to really get into it is to get into spoilers, because within the first less than five minutes, a huge spoiler happens. And so we really want to encourage you to go see this film. Even if you're not a fan of horror, it's an incredible film on an emotional level and on a technical level with what they're able to do with sound. If you are into like world building, they do some really cool world building elements in this, just in this, like what they create with like, okay, how do you get around causing sound? And so
it's definitely more of a like thriller drama that happens to have a monster in it than it is a horror film.
Yeah. I feel like so often, at least this is my perception, when I think of horror, I either think of like people getting torn up like in a Saw-esque way, or I think of like constant jump scares. And it's not really either of those. It's like, it's horror in the sense that like it's scary, but it's more like Jake said, like a suspenseful film. It's not
there's
like
no
jump
gore.
Scares.
There's like a little bit of blood, but that's basically it. Like this is,
but like it's blood that's like not,
it makes sense.
Wound blood.
Yeah. It makes sense. And like, I would recommend everybody see this film. I think there's something here for everybody. If you can watch Stranger Things, you can watch this.
That's a great comparison. It's yes. Great job, Jake. But yeah, we're going to go ahead and get into spoilers. So go see A Quiet Place, then come back, listen to the rest of this podcast. So, we've already talked about this a little bit, but let's talk about the use of sound in this film, because it's obviously what this film is going to be talked about for years to come. So, the diegetic sound that Krasinski uses. So on set, most of the sound that you hear in the movie is actually sound that was captured on set. They've just heightened. Brings a couple things to mind, but one of the first things it brings to mind is like, I wonder what production was like on this. Like, is everybody just like as still as possible so that they can get like Krasinski walking on this sand as quiet as possible? I mean, the use of sound in this film is just incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I think obviously the quiet on set thing is like real. It's not just a made up thing on TV shows. Like they actually have to get good audio in their recording. But I read the script today. It's only a 60 page script, which we'll talk more about later. But like there might not be any dialogue in the script that isn't a flashback. And so to create a film like this, you have to have good sound design, because sound design is one of those things that like filmmakers don't really appreciate until they get kind of later into their career. I think most people are like, oh yeah, cinematography, oh yeah, editing, yeah, writing and directing. And then like you do a project and you're like, this just feels flat. It doesn't have that sound design, you know? And so I think this is one of those films where if it doesn't have good sound design, it doesn't work. Like the creatures don't feel real. The world doesn't feel real. You don't have the tension. You don't have the suspense. It is a totally different movie. It would not work without the sound design. And the realness of the diegetic sound is so strong. It makes the world feel so real. It makes the house feel lived in. It makes it feel like you're in the space with them. And then the score, I think, complements the sound design really well. It's subtle enough to set a mood, but not so calling attention to itself that it's distracting you away from what is happening both visually and audibly on screen. And so, I mean, Krasinski did an incredible job of directing the sound for this film, which I think a lot of people forget that that's also the job of the director. They're directing everything, and sound design is a huge part of that, especially in a film like this.
Yeah, I feel like the sound that he allows to come in and the sound that he leaves out is incredibly telling of the capabilities of him as a director. I think the first time, like if I'm getting really nitpicky, the first time the score came in, I was a little bit thrown off, but then it's used as this like nice, like tension break. Like it gets you out of there for a second and it kind of gives you this like break,
mm-hmm.
and you're able to like take a breath, reset, and then go back in. It's almost like, like if you're like a swimmer, it's like you come up for air and then you get back down into your strokes. It's not like you're not doing a full lap without breathing, which would just like exhaust you and destroy you. But instead it's like, okay, couple strokes, breath, couple strokes, breath. And the sound is used incredibly well in that it aids in like the effectiveness of when it's not there, you notice it all the more because you've had this score and then you go without it for a little bit.
Yeah. And the score, so this is basically a silent film. Like, yes, there's sound design and everything, but this is a silent film in terms of like the actors aren't talking. We are only seeing what's happening on screen. And fortunately, because it's 2018, we're also hearing the world that they live in, but they're not communicating with speech. And so a huge part of the mood is the music. Like even silent films in the 20s and 30s, like they had music underneath them, you know? So I thought the music was a strong choice. I'm glad that they didn't go only diegetic sound, because the music adds so much tension. A lot of times when we do these reviews, I try and sit down and write out all my thoughts at least some point after seeing the film and before the review, and I try and listen to the score of the film while I do that, because it brings back the feelings of being in the theater. And man, this score is like subtle enough to where it doesn't call attention to itself, but there's so much sonically going on underneath that just like makes the hair on your arms and neck stand up. I was getting tense just writing my thoughts out, man. I mean, it was it was tough.
What do you think of the scenes where they brought you into Millicent Simmons, who is Emily Blunt and John Krasinski's character's daughter, their deaf daughter? What did you think of the scenes where they bring you into what her sound experience is like? Like, it's almost like they bring you into like a vacuum,
mm-hmm.
of like the space without sound, and you almost just have the static. What did you think of that?
I loved it. I mean, I think it was really strong character development and also used in a way to create tension. It brings us into her world while we're also able to see what she isn't able to see. or hear. And so it creates that fun horror element where the audience knows what's about to happen before the subject knows, but then the director puts a twist on it and then nobody knows what's about to happen. And that happens a lot in this film. And Krasinski does an awesome job with that. And I think that that was a really strong thing to do, especially towards the end of the film. There's a scene where the two kids are in a truck hiding, very Jurassic Park. And we see her watching the boy's reaction to the monster because she can't hear the monster coming. And that was so strong. Like all the sound went out. You see just the physical, emotional reaction of the boy and then her connecting with what's happening. And it just like makes you so empathetic to that character and the world that she lives in as these things are trying to hunt them down by using sound. And she can't hear the sound she's making. It just breaks your heart. And so I thought that that was a really, really strong choice and used sparingly. Like if it was every time we saw her, it would have been too much and wouldn't have worked. It would have been almost like a crutch, I think. But they use it in just the right moments and it was really strong.
Yeah. So that's a good segue into my favorite part of this movie, which is Millicent Simmons acting. She is actually deaf in real life, and what she's able to bring to this role as somebody who is actually deaf and is playing a deaf character in a world that's silent is incredible. I mean, she gives off so much charisma in this role. She's able to emote so many different things through her physical presence that I hope that she's able to just continually get roles and roles and roles, because she is somebody who is just a delight to watch on screen from beginning to end. I felt like I was watching the career of a star blossom in this role, because she was just a delight. Like every time she was on screen, I'm like, you have so much power and range in what you're doing. And it was one of those roles where you're just like, I hope you get so much praise for this, because you deserve all of it. She is incredible in this role, and you feel every single sign that she gives to her parents or to her brother, or every single look, not in a way that's like, oh, that's over the top, but in a that's how somebody would react in that situation. And you feel that in your gut of wow, I wonder what it's like to be in her world.
Yeah.
She's incredible.
Yeah. It's really interesting that the Best Picture winner last year also had a lot of sign language in it, which is cool. Because I feel like for a long time, filmmaking didn't really know what to do with deaf or mute people because dialogue is so important. And I totally agree with everything that you said. I mean, she is a delight to watch. She's fantastic. And I mean, she is throwing punches with Emily Blunt and John Krasinski, two incredible actors. And I mean, she is holding her own and she's deaf, and that's amazing. And I definitely agree with the thought that the best thing you can do to set yourself up for success with your film is good casting. That is the most important part of pre-production, is casting the right people. And it literally determines the trajectory of your film. And when you're working with kids, it can be really hard to get them to act, to go into a place that they don't know or they don't understand because they haven't had those life experiences. And so kudos to John Krasinski and their casting director for deciding to cast an actual deaf person, a deaf child in this role, because she brings so much experience to it that you can tell that this is her world. It doesn't feel out of place. She is fantastic, and they really set her up for success, and in turn that made the film even better.
Getting more into the acting, couples who are actors who act in the same film together don't have a great track record of those films being well received. And so what did you think of Krasinski and Blunt, a real life married couple playing a married couple in this film?
They're the best. Like, like couple goals, hashtag yeah, exactly. relationship goals. I mean, Emily Blunt is incredible. Like, she is a force on screen. The pain, the emotion, the love, the humor that she's able to convey without even using words is amazing. I think that's the most impressive thing is they're giving silent performances and they're still able to convey so much emotion. John Krasinski is also incredible. I don't think he shows the range that Blunt shows in this film, but I think that lines up with his character of being the protector and putting this burden on his shoulders. He just, you can just feel the weight that is on his shoulders at all times. And he does an incredible job, and they together have such chemistry on screen that doesn't feel like a relationship in another world that is then them to like, it feels like that couple, like they mm-hmm. are acting together in that role, in that world. I can't imagine doing that with my wife and then also having to direct my wife. I can't imagine doing that. So it worked out clearly. Hopefully their marriage isn't hurt by that. We'll see what happens. But I mean, they both were fantastic. And then also the kid, the younger kid, I forget his name, but the son,
Noah Jupe,
he's amazing in this. Like mm-hmm. all four of them are fantastic. Yeah.
So with the film only being four people, I mean, and yes, you can argue that there's a little bit more in some ways, between the man in the woods, and their youngest son but with those four main people, did you ever feel like this was too small? Were you ever wanting more from this world?
No, I loved how small and intimate this film was. I mean, we're given the information that we need and just dropped into this world with this family. And if I was thinking about it this morning, most of this film is happening in real time. Mm-hmm. Like, there are only a few jumps in times and locations, and it feels almost like a play in the way that it's so small and intimate and so happening right now. We are in this right now situation. And I absolutely loved it. Those are my favorite kind of films that are in the kind of like disaster category where it's just like a character study in a crazy situation. I don't care that the entire world is being terraformed by whatever movie you want it to be terraformed in. I don't care. Like, I have no connection with these people or the stakes. This film, the stakes were, I guess technically they were low in terms of body count, sure, but like they felt so high in the theater. So much connection to these characters because you spend so much time with them. Right. And they do an incredible job.
But it's like, so you mentioned the body count being incredibly low, but to me, it's like the body count felt enormous because it's like, mm-hmm. this is all that's left of society mm-hmm. is this family. And then we also kind of get this like glimpse of like, they light a fire on top of their silo. And then like a couple neighboring families almost look like they light up fires of like, hey, we're still here and good to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so like it gives you a small little perspective in that regard, but it's not this like World War Z-esque global scale of like disaster and my yeah. family, but it's like, this is a family with parents just trying to do the best they can. And that's ultimately what I took away from this movie was I was sitting in this movie and I remember like thinking like, what is this movie about? Like, what's Krasinski trying to say? And I really just feel like he's trying to give us a perspective of like, parenting is hard. Like, and I'm not saying that as like I'm a parent, like, look at me, parenting is hard, but it's like the choices that you have to make in order for the betterment of your family and the weight from that is just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you constantly just have this like weight on your shoulder of wanting to provide the best for your life, for your kids, and wanting to love them and show them that love. But sometimes it's like, you can't show them that love because you need to be like looking out for them. And it's just like the ways that you have to be a parent and navigate that are so complicated, and that role within a family is like, look, the hardest thing for us to ever go through is for us to not be together. But like, as long as we're together, like, know that, like, I love you and that I'm here for you. And I mean, that takes us to a moment in this movie that honestly made me cry. Which I didn't expect from this film. And it's, you know, you get to the end of the film and John Krasinski's trying to save his kids from this monster and they're getting attacked. This truck that they're in is getting attacked while they're inside of it. And he could tell, like, the truck's not going to last. And so he makes this decision to sacrifice himself. And he screams, after signing that he loves his daughter. And it's just this, like, real moment. Like, you feel completely helpless, but understanding and compatible with him in that moment. And I think for people that, like, I think that that moment is just such a universal thing of, like, for people that you love, you would do anything for them.
Yeah.
And, like, you, even if, like, you want them to constantly know that, like, outside of this action, like, if there's any confusion whatsoever, just know, like, I love you. Like, I love you more than life itself. And, like, that's the choice that he makes, is, like, he loves his kids more than life itself. And he is willing to die for them. And it's perfectly set up. It's perfectly executed. And when John Krasinski screams, you're just like, oh, crap. Because you know, like, you feel like it's this gut feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And I mean, John Krasinski has said basically that in multiple interviews of just, this is about what you're willing to do as a parent for your family. But it's also like, it says so much more than that too. And that's what I love about this film. It's about kids growing up and wanting the respect of their parents. It's about healing from tragedy and loss. It's about how we blame ourselves and how everybody ends up taking on some blame, even though it might not be their fault. It's about communication in a world without speech. It's about strengths and weaknesses and how they're often connected. It's an unexpectedly beautiful religious allegory. And it's just so much more than a horror movie. Like, the performances and the story of this movie are so strong and rooted in something that the audience can truly connect with. And that's why this lands so well and why I teared up multiple times.
Yeah. Yeah. So, backpedaling a little bit, that opening scene, were you expecting, you know, that spaceship goes off, the sound starts going, were you expecting that scene to end the way it did?
No. Cause I mean, I'd seen that scene somewhere online before and it obviously cuts before what happens. But I think, I mean, it needed to happen. You need something like that to set the stakes. And it perfectly creates the world, establishes the rules, and just punches you in the gut and just lets you know, like, this is where we are. This is what's happening. And it sucks. And like, it, and it just perfectly builds the world in that little 5-minute snippet. It establishes, like, there aren't many people left. You have to be quiet. They walk everywhere barefoot, so they're close to wherever they're going. And if you make a sound, this giant thing's going to come and kill you really fast. And, like, that's really all you need to know for the rest of the film.
It sets up the stakes from a very early on. Like, look, we're not, like, they kind of disregarded, like, a huge rule that so many movies have of, like, they kill the little kid within the first 5 minutes. Like, normally most movies are afraid to, like, kill off a character, let alone the youngest, arguably the cutest little character. And they, I mean, he gets killed within the first 5 minutes. And from that moment, you're like, okay, it's almost like you back up and you're like, okay. Like, put down the gun. We understand the stakes.
Anything's on the table at that point.
Right. And like, you could, at that point, it's like, and that's what makes the Emily Blunt bathtub scene, where she's giving birth in the bathtub, so much better, because you're like, they've already killed a little kid. Like, who's to say they wouldn't kill Emily Blunt in this, like, scene?
That that whole scene, like the first scene, phenomenal filmmaking. Like it just totally establishes the world, does everything it needs to do, and is also just like really emotional, really well done. But that labor nail bathtub sequence,
oh, the nail,
and like the family coming back, and just like that. That's like a 45, that's like the beginning of a 45 minute long sequence in this film that is a roller coaster. Like it's some of the best filmmaking I've seen in a really long time, and just visual storytelling. That's all this is. It's just incredible visual storytelling. And Emily Blunt nails it. John Krasinski nails it. The kids nail it. But man, that nail bathtub combo was like, I was on the edge of my seat with my sweatshirt in my mouth, like biting on. I was just like, no.
But it's also like, well, for lack of a better example, like the Jurassic Park thing, mm-hmm. in that it's smart people doing smart things and bad things just keep on happening.
Yeah.
Instead of like, oh, she just decided to run out into the middle of the field and give labor. It's like, no, she tried to do the smart, like she lit the lights, she tried to go down to the basement, but she like stepped on a nail that was like planted earlier in the movie. And it's like these smart people keep doing smart things and bad things just keep happening, which makes you as a viewer feel even more helpless of like, well, yeah, that's what I would have done. It's not like, well, why did you walk down into the creepy basement where there's dead bodies hanging like in Texas Chainsaw? Like nobody would ever do that. You'd be like, nope, I'm out. I'm good. I'm going to call the cops. I'm going to come and then let them handle this. I'm good. Not going to explore. This is like, no, these are incredibly smart people making incredibly smart choices that every step of the way, bad things just keep happening. And you're like, oh gosh,
yeah.
Like I would be toast in this world, which makes you then as a viewer have even more respect for these people because you're like, I couldn't hang. I wouldn't be able to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the level that they go to and like the detail of the world building of just like how much they think things through and like how prepared the family was for then everything to go to crap. It, like you said, it just makes you be like, man, this just life. Nothing works out, yeah. Man. It's crazy.
And this movie also has one of the more BA endings I've seen in a long time of Millicent Simmons' character realizing that this cochlear implant that her dad had been trying to build and work on for her so that she could hear and that ends up emitting this high frequency noise is actually the weakness of the monsters. And then you get this like scene where it's like her and her mom just destroy this monster together. And then it's like that final shot of them like standing there and like you see the monsters coming on the cameras. And Emily Blunt just like cocks the gun. You're like,
yeah,
like that's a way to end a movie.
That was epic. And I loved just the cliffhangerness of it. But like, right. It also, you know what's going to happen. Like that was the climax of the film. We don't need anything else after that. Like you,
right.
What else is there going to be besides like a downer of them putting a headstone up for John Krasinski's character? Like that's really the only thing you can go to after the big battle climax. So I think it loses the impact when you do that. And
right.
So this is just like, it's still in the moment, still sacrifice, like, and the world building of like letting the characters have an imprint on the world around them. They're like downstairs in the dad's space with all of the hearing aids. And I mean, it's just like such good character development on every aspect of the mom, the daughter, the dad, even though he's already sacrificed himself.
Right.
And then it's just like epic, just epic BA-ness of Emily Blunt. Such a good way to end the film. So strong.
You know, you get to the end of this film and you're kind of sitting there. And one of my first thoughts was, you know, a lot of times with first-time directors, they're still kind of figuring, and not first time, because this is John Krasinski's third film, but a first big film that the mass majority of people have seen. I watched this, and I was sitting there thinking, like, how much of this movie is a success because of the cast or because of the script? Or how much of this is a script because of John Krasinski's direct hand as a director? And I ended up walking away thinking like it's a pretty significant portion. I think the choices that he makes in this film and the way that he balances emotion and horror pretty strongly leave his stamp as a strong director. Jake, I know that you had read the script and had some insider thought as to why Krasinski walks out of this looking like a pretty great director.
Yeah, I mean, I am truly blown away by what John Krasinski does here, what he pulled off. And I am rooting for him and wouldn't be surprised if he got a Best Director nod come award season. I mean, I read the original script today, and before he got involved, it was a very different movie. And I truly believed that he saved this film and elevated it from a B-horror film to a truly great film that will stand next to the horror greats, but also is elevated above the horror genre in general. He's able to get incredible performances out of himself, his wife, and two children, one of which is actually deaf. He's then able to guide his film through the chaos that is post-production, and he created something truly unique. Like, I love what he did here. I think it's incredibly strong. The script is not strong. I mean, it's good. Like, the basis of this story is there, but the first scene isn't in the film at all. The characters are totally different. There's tons of flashbacks happening that are establishing, like, what happened to the characters, which we don't need, and also are totally different than what's happening in this film. The sequences happen in totally different times, and, like, he rewrote this script. Like, I would say 50% of this film is different than what the script was originally. And he saved this movie and made it a 99% on Rotten Tomatoes, like a huge profit. He can make anything he wants right now based on this. And he did an incredible job. I can't wait to see what he does next. And he is on his way to Menchiness.
He is on his way to Menchiness. He was very close as Jim Halpert, but I feel like if he gets another film such as this as a director, he's pretty close.
Yeah.
One of the things that I mentioned a little bit ago was how he blends emotion and horror. And I think in the quietness of this movie, we come to love these characters and feel close to them. We see the choices that he's forced to make as a dad. We see the forces, we see the way that the kids react to those choices, just being kids. And all of that just gives us this real world feel of, like, these are people that we know and love and can relate to, and gives us this incredible attachment to these characters that makes those final scenes even more impactful. And so, yeah, I think John Krasinski's, on his way to being a top-notch director if he can kind of keep this type of thing up. One of the final things I want to talk about is the similarities between this and a movie we reviewed last year called It Comes at Night, starring Joel Edgerton and a bunch of other people. Did you get similarities in the movie between these two?
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that before you sent notes for the show, and I was like, we are on the same page. I think there are three big reasons why this movie works and It Comes at Night doesn't. First off, this film is actually what it was marketed as. Like, you walk in expecting it to be a horror film, and it is, but you're delightfully surprised that it's so much more than that. It Comes at Night is the opposite. In this film, we watch a family come together and work together, and you are empathetic to the characters. It Comes at Night, not so much. And here there's an actual antagonist that they're working against, and It Comes at Night is not that as well. I mean, everything that this film does right, It Comes at Night does the opposite. And I'm higher on It Comes at Night than I was in our original review. After thinking about it, some things came to light that elevated it for me. But I mean, these two movies are in totally different leagues, and it's because of the direction of John Krasinski, and just like how tight of a film this is. and that it's about a family coming together, and it's about things that we as humans aspire to do in those situations where It Comes at Night is everything goes to hell and nothing works, and it's really depressing.
Yeah, it's, I feel like this able is to capitalize a lot more on the relationships and on the family aspect. I'm curious because I haven't thought about it that much since we first saw it as in It Comes at Night. And so it's interesting to me because that film, like Jake said, was completely different in theater than what was marketed. And so I'm curious if I went into that movie blind, what I would think about it. There's a scene in that movie that's truly haunting that still sticks with me and kind of gives me the chills to this day that I'll never forget or be able to unhear. And they're completely different movies that leave you with completely different effects. And I feel like I've said this before. I'm somebody who, like, I want to go to the movies and leave in a better place than I left it or than I entered it. And I don't feel like that way with It Comes at Night. And it's just because it's just such a dark movie. And, like, that's fine. Like, I think I said it during the podcast. Like, it's a good movie. It's just not for me. Like, it's not my style of movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's well made. It looks good. Like, pacing's fine. But it's just not for me. Whereas, like, this movie, like, leaves you with hope at the end. And, like, causes you to go introspective of, like, what would I do in these situations? Instead of that movie that's just kind of like this, like, bleak, dark outlook of, like, life is lost.
Yeah.
Would you want a sequel to A Quiet Place? The writers have already said that they kind of have different set pieces and ideas for a sequel, but do you feel like this is a film that needs or even, like, should have a sequel?
I don't think it needs a sequel. This movie is so tight and, like, such an amazing little character study that I'm very content with what they've already given us, and I don't need any more from this. If they are going to do a sequel, I think you get new characters. Like, it's a story of one of the other families or something, of the Fires, potentially. But I only am interested if John Krasinski is involved because of the heavy lifting he did in rewrites and directing this film. If he is not involved, I am not interested.
Yeah, I'm with you. Krasinski is the only way I'm interested, but I'm slightly different. Like, I feel like we've put a lot into these characters that I would almost be frustrated to not see where they go from here. I want to see, like, okay, what is the next step? Like, the movie leads us to believe, like, okay, they defeat these next two monsters, but where do we go from there? And I think it's kind of almost a perfect place for them to explore and go into this world of, like, the one complaint I would have for this movie is, like, how the government or other people haven't figured out that for animals that hear that high sound frequencies bother them, like, how that wasn't, and maybe that was connected, but, like, maybe they destroyed society so quickly that that message didn't have time to get out. But, like, I'd like for them to, like, explore that maybe a little bit more, or, like, I think there's some interesting places that they can go, and, like, it's a fun concept in, like, the sound element of it that I think there's a lot they can do with that. So, yeah, if Krasinski's back directing, I'm interested, but I also kind of want a continuation. If they were going to do a sequel, I don't necessarily think it needs one, but if they were going to, the only way I'm really interested is if it's a somewhat continuation of this actual story. Jake, do you have any final thoughts on this movie?
No. I mean, my rating is an A++++. Like, you cannot change really anything about this movie and make it better. Like, it might make it a little different, but I don't know what you can give or take away to improve the film. We haven't touched on cinematography or editing that much, but they are flawless. Nothing feels weak or out of place or distracting, which is exactly what you want. And, like, who would have thought that Jim Halpert had one of the best horror films in him? Like, it's so out of the blue, but I'm so glad it was made. I love this movie, and I'm super excited to see it again. I'm going to try to see it again in the theaters before it leaves. But, yeah, I mean, everybody go see this film. tell your friends to see this movie. I think this is the Get Out of 2018. And by that, I mean like the surprise horror hit that will last the rest of the year and into award season. So A Quiet Place, huge home run, grand slam, a grand slam for John Krasinski.
Game 7 of the World Series grand slam.
Yep.
Yeah, Jake, I'm with you. It's an A-plus in my book. I very rarely give A-pluses to movies on the first viewing because I feel like movies just so often get better when you view them again that first time, you know, you're just trying to figure things out. And so, but this is a movie that like I fell in love with the very first time I watched it. It's a beautiful film. It's an incredible family story. It's an incredibly, incredibly paced film in how it's like done from beginning to end. There's pauses, but like the pauses have such character building in them. But yeah, I love this movie. It's an A+. It's my favorite movie of the year so far. And I'm curious to see if another film will top it by the end of the year.
Yeah.
But that's all we have for our review of A Quiet Place. Go check that out in theaters now. It is well worth your time. It's only an hour and a half. I say it only an hour and a half, knowing that that's a long time, but it's not nearly as long as most movies. But if even if you're not into horror, I would highly recommend checking it out because I think it's well worth your time. Let's go ahead and get to our content of the week. Jake, what is your content of the week?
I have two films to recommend this week. First off is starring the lovely Emily Blunt, who kills it in A Quiet Place. And that is a film that is, I think, one of the best sci-fi films of the last 10 years and is an example of what terrible marketing can do to your film. And that is Edge of Tomorrow, also known as Live, okay. Die, Repeat.
See, I was curious. I only know it as Live, Die, Repeat. I haven't heard this other title that you speak of.
Yeah, just the stupidest marketing for an incredible film that, like, not enough people saw. It's a lot of fun. If you liked this film, I think you'll like Edge of Tomorrow, but it's just fantastic. So definitely go check that out. And then another film to recommend that is very similar to A Quiet Place and probably a big inspiration for A Quiet Place. It's M. Night Shyamalan's Signs, starring Mel Gibson.
Yes.
And I definitely see a lot of similarities in these two films. I think A Quiet Place is significantly better. But yeah, if you are a fan of the aliens invade family character study, Signs is a great film to check out after watching A Quiet Place.
Nice. In honor of the 25th anniversary, I'm going to recommend The Sandlot, which is the, in my opinion, my favorite baseball movie of all time. I love baseball, and that's, it's hard to believe that film has been out for 25 years. It makes me feel incredibly old. So that's weird. Outside of that, I've been watching a show from CBS that is only on CBS Online. And yes, I'm recommending a CBS show. So
I can't believe it.
That's weird. I'm recommending a CBS show that's not Survivor. There you go. How about that? And that show is CBS's Star Trek Discovery.
Oh.
Which I've watched the first 5 episodes of. There's 15 episodes in the first season. And it's incredible. Like,
really?
It's very, very good. I would highly recommend getting a CBS All Access trial or whatever for a week to binge the show, because it's the CGI on it's incredible. The storytelling's amazing. The characters are great. I mean, I like this better than any of the Star Trek movies that have come out recently.
Whoa.
And I say that fully acknowledging that Chris Pine is one of my top 5 favorite actors working today.
Wow. So that's high praise.
Yeah, it's just it's very interesting. It moves at a great pace. It's got great actors. It's got, for a TV show, it's got incredible visual effects, and I'm excited to see hopefully the rest of the season keeps up that pace. But yeah, go check that out. CBS's Star Trek Discovery. That's all we have for this week's episode. We'll be back next week with another review and another episode. If you've enjoyed listening to us, then please go to iTunes, subscribe, rate, review us, and go share us with your friends and family. If you want to know more about us, you can go to our website at popcornoptional.com, where you can find all of our episodes, as well as a little bit about who we are as people. If you want to interact with us, you can find us on Twitter at Popcorn Optional or on Facebook at Popcorn Optional. My name's Cameron Selena. You can find me online at 321CamiTime. Jake, where can we find you online?
You can find me on Instagram at jakebrown.tv. That is also my website. So just put that in the URL and you'll find me.
Trevor can be found online at TurboTrevor, and he will be back next week. We hope you guys have a great week. Watch as many movies as possible. In the words of the great Michael Scott, we'll be back ASAP as possible.